Hello and welcome to Power Play for this Friday, June the 4th. I'm Joyce Napier. Coming up on the show, a call to the Catholic Church.
As a Catholic, I am deeply disappointed by the position that the Catholic Church has taken now and over the past many years.
The Prime Minister today urged Catholics to call on their church to acknowledge its role in the residential school tragedies and apologize. But can and should the government take legal action to obtain hidden records? We'll ask Northern Affairs Minister Dan Vandel, then get opposition reaction. And acting on missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls.
Both today's federal pathway and the National Action Plan really will be accountable to all of the families and survivors coast to coast to coast.
The federal government promises action on funding and concrete timelines for implementing the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls Report. Does the action plan meet the standards of those who ran the inquiry? We'll ask former Commissioner Michelle Audette. Plus, a creative push to accelerate vaccinations. Windsor's mayor wants citizens to walk right up to the border line to get American COVID-19 vaccine doses without leaving the country. We'll bring in Windsor Mayor Drew Dilkins. This is Power Play. Let's get to the players. The chief of the Tecumloops Wet'suwet'en First Nations wants an apology after the shocking discovery of 215 children found buried at the former residential school in Kamloops, B.C. The band's announcement last week of the discovery has touched off nationwide grief and anger over the children's treatment at residential schools and calls for more searches at other such institutions.
What we do want an apology, a public apology, not just for us, but for the world who also shared in those suffrages. Holding the Catholic Church to account, there has never been an apology from the Roman Catholics.
How will the government ensure that an apology is made? And is the government committed to finding all of the children who never made it home from residential schools? Let's talk to Northern Affairs Minister Dan Vandel. Minister, thank you for taking the time. Welcome to Power Play. Now, we know, and we
Good
just
to be
heard,
here, Joyce.
Chief Casimir in Kamloops wants an apology from the Catholic Church. Would that be part of the healing process? Would that bring closure to the families and the survivors?
Well, first of all, I agree with the chief that certainly the Catholic Church and the Pope must apologize. It's something that's been important to Canadians for a long time. I know the Prime Minister, in speaking to the Pope several years ago, asked the Pope to apologize, and I think it should happen. And right now, it's really up to Catholics to do what they can to try to encourage the bishops and the Pope to actually move forward on this apologize for this shameful part of Canada's history.
So basically, the Prime Minister asking Canadians to do something that he was unable to do. I was on that trip with the Prime Minister when he went to the Vatican to ask for a papal apology and came back, obviously, without one. But I want us, Minister, to take a listen at the Prime Minister's comments about an apology from the Catholic Church. Let's take a listen.
It'll be a really important moment for all of us, particularly Catholics across the country, to reach out in our local parishes, to reach out to bishops and cardinals, and make it clear that we expect the Church to take up and step up and take responsibility for its role in this and be there to help in the grieving and the healing, including with records, that is necessary.
But Minister Vandel, is an apology enough? Will the government, for instance, push the Catholic Church for action in addition to an apology? He talked about records, the Prime Minister, to show Canada and the Canadian people and Indigenous communities those records.
Yeah, no, I agree. First of all, this is a story that is not going away. If you read the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, they underestimated the number of children that were killed in residential schools. So it's only a matter of time before another site is found and Canadians go through this horror, this grieving, this heartbreak, this outrage once again. And the calls for everything begins with an apology. And I firmly believe the Catholic Church should apologize. They should hand over all pertinent documents for future healing. But of course, it's not enough. How can an apology be enough for the horror that went on in this country for generations? Apology is never going to be enough. But nonetheless, that's what the journey to reconciliation is about. First, you've got to hear the truth. You've got to apologize for the injustices that were committed, and then you work on reconciliation.
But do you have, does the Canadian government minister have an avenue, for instance, to get those records, to get that apology? I mean, the schools were created by the Canadian government as the Catholic Church to help them run them. Does the Canadian government have legal avenue to go after the Vatican and to get those records?
You know what? The Canadian government is representative of Canadian people. And Canadian people, I believe, want the Catholic Church to apologize. As far as the legal questions, I don't know. I'm not going to commit to an answer on that. But right now, I think the public mood in our country is heartbroken. It's outrage, and I think we have to get to the truth. We have to get to an apology by the Catholic Church, and then we have to work on reconciliation.
Okay, so what now, Minister? What would you like to see? Now, we've got these discovered graves. They are a crime scene and at the same time a burial ground, something, you know, more spiritual. Should there be a forensic investigation to get to the bottom of this? Is there consensus in the various Indigenous communities about the way forward?
You know what? I think that's a great question. I think we have to work with the various Indigenous communities, the First Nation communities where the grave sites are held, and work at their pace. We know that it's certainly not there's a diversity in how First Nations want to approach this. Some First Nations want every single individual identified. Other First Nations would probably like a collective commemoration. And so it's up to the government to offer support to the First Nations who are victims of residential schools. And it's up to the federal government to offer support and work at the pace of the individual First Nations. We have made 27 million dollars available for the work that needs to be done, and we will work with First Nations.
Do you think the RCMP should be part of that investigation?
I believe the RCMP are actually involved now to some degree. At what level, I'm not sure. But I think that you cannot help but have the RCMP involved, and I think they probably are involved at this point.
Well, I am sure we will talk again about this. You said it at the beginning of our conversation, Minister, this story won't go away. Dan Van Dahl, Northern Affairs Minister, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Thank you, Joyce.
So you just heard from the Liberal government. Now let's hear what the opposition has to say. Joining me now is Jamie Schmale, Conservative Shadow Minister for Crown Indigenous Relations, and Nikki Ashton, NDP MP in Manitoba. Hello to both of you. Welcome to Power Play. Nice to see you. I know you can't see each other, but you look amazing. Nikki Ashton, let me ask you first. I'm looking at your tweets. You call this a genocide. What would you like to see this government do?
Well, first of all, act. I mean, the responses we've heard over the last few days just don't cut it. Our nation, Canada as a whole, has been shocked by what was found at the Kamloops Residential School. 215 children in a mass grave. What we need to see is the federal government step up and show leadership. We need to see an independent body assembled to oversee and assist in these searches. And we need to see international experts come in. Today, I joined Pimichikamak Cree Nation, a First Nation in our region, who have called on the International Commission of Missing Persons, a body that has done this work, has uncovered mass graves and genocide in conflict zones around the world. Canada is no different. This is a genocide. We need to make sure that this is taken seriously at all levels. And right now, it's pretty clear to me that it's not. And that includes holding the Catholic Church and churches to account. The Prime Minister and this government are not detached from this reality. Canada is responsible for this genocide, and we need to expose the truth to be able to move forward.
Jamie Schmale, how do you expose the truth?
Well, I agree with my friend from the NDP who talked about the need for action right now. And this is where it is a bit concerning, especially after the horrific discovery of the 215 children in Kamloops, BC. When you look at the Truth and Reconciliation Report, about a dozen of the 90 plus calls to action have been accomplished so far. This is a major failure on the behalf of the government, considering the importance of these recommendations. And now we have 200 more calls to justice in the Murdered and Missing Indigenous Women and Girls report, which we have been waiting quite some time for the action plan for the government and them to respond. And at this pace, I think it's very concerning about when we will actually see action on these points and how much of a priority is it for the government, because I can tell you for these First Nations communities, it is extremely important.
And I want to get to a papal apology, Nikki Ashton. So how important is the apology? Is it not getting those records, getting the Vatican to give those records? Because the Vatican takes notes on everything, has incredible records there in the Vatican. Would that not be a path to at least finding out what happened to these children and other children? Because these are not the only ones. So beyond the apology, how do you push the Vatican to release that information?
Well, absolutely. This is beyond an apology. An apology would be a start, but we need to make sure that the records are made available to First Nations. We need to make sure that there are investigations into those, including clergy, that committed this horrific abuse and under whose oversight this abuse, this murder took place, this genocide took place. And we need to make sure that there are reparations, right? Canada lectures the world on human rights, on justice. And just in the last few days, we have uncovered a mass grave of 215 Indigenous children that were abducted by the Canadian state and sent to a school. This is shocking. It is unacceptable. We need to see the federal government pull out all the stops, including holding the Catholic Church responsible. And we're not seeing that now. First Nations are calling for it. Canadians are calling for it. We need to see the federal government step up.
Well, how does the federal government, Jamie Schmale, how does the federal government, we've got the UN here urging the church in Rome to release, and to hand over documents. How does the Canadian government force the Vatican to apologize?
That's a good question. I think through diplomatic channels, I think there is a lot of international pressure, as you just mentioned, on the federal government to take action on the Vatican to respond to that. But there's also the other piece as well, as the action that is being called upon right this second, including taking an action plan on the Truth and Reconciliation Recommendation 71 to 76, with deals with the situation we're dealing with now, because we know that we should be funding investigations on sites that are believed to have other remains right across this country, because I do believe First Nations communities are looking for answers and they should be getting them. And this is where I think we, as the Conservative opposition and the NDP, are on side step by step, is that we want the government, and the government needs to take action right now. And enough of the delays. Let's start giving these communities answers and potential closure.
But in order to give these communities answers, Nikki, and to find out what happened, there has to be some forensic digging in these sites. But not all the communities want to see the same actions. So how do you reach a consensus of these various Indigenous communities to get to the bottom of it? I mean, a forensic investigation is so different than this being, you know, a sort of sacred burial ground. It will take some digging. It will take some things that are, you know, perhaps a little bit shocking.
Mm-hmm. Well, look, I think it's really important that we take guidance from the messages of Justice Murray Sinclair of the Truth and Reconciliation Commissioners. They spoke to a parliamentary committee this week, and they recommended a independent committee be struck to oversee this undertaking. First Nations are in different places when it comes to this, but I can tell you right now, every single First Nation across our region, here in our constituency, have made it clear there must be action. And you know, First Nations do not trust the federal government on this in particular. And why would they? The federal government was the entity that pushed for their kids to be abducted and taken to these schools, that set up these schools. And so we must see an independent committee struck that can work with First Nations, that can work with communities, and that can work with international experts like the International Commission on Missing Persons, who have expertise in this area. There are people that know how to do this work. But one option that is not on the table is just sitting here and listening to the federal government tell us that they're sorry and that Canada has failed them. That's not good enough. People want to see action.
Jamie Schmel, last question to you. I don't have a lot of time left, unfortunately. So an independent body to investigate, is that the solution?
That's potentially one solution. We're open to ideas, and we're looking to work with the opposition parties, with the government, on a path forward here. And I think the common denominator in all of this is that action is required. Action is required now, and it must be serious and meaningful. And I think we're all on the same page with that. I think Canadians are on the same page with that. And as you mentioned before, the international community is really pushing for it as well. So I think we owe it to these communities to move forward now, listen to what they're talking about, listen to what they need, and then respond.
Yes, and we will be talking about this for a while. Jamie Schmel, Nikki Ashton, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us. Have yourselves a lovely weekend.
You too.
You too. Thank you.
For the Indigenous community, the pain and trauma of residential schools, of course, is intergenerational. For survivors and families, there is a crisis line available 24 hours a day. That number is 1-866-925-4419. And coming up, 231 calls for justice. The National Inquiry into Missing and Murdered Women and Girls released those calls for justice 2 years ago. The feds have finally revealed their pathway plan to address them. So what does a former inquiry commissioner have to say about the nation's action plan? We'll speak to Michel Audet next. Stay with us.
It means that no one will ever be able to accuse any of the partners of having this plan sit on a shelf. We will continue to be able to be accountable for the results we're getting, and the timelines and the funding will be explicit in the implementation plan.
That was Crown Indigenous Relations Minister Carolyn Bennett discussing the federal government's long-awaited national action plan on missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. It's been 2 years since the inquiry, the National Inquiry, released their final report outlining 231 calls for justice. Critics are saying the federal pathway to address violence against Indigenous women and girls and LGBTQ2 spirit people lacks concrete timelines and detailed costing plans. Minister Bennett says those issues will be addressed when an implementation plan gets finalized this year. Despite already being a year late in producing the plan, how can the government be trusted to act on the calls for justice in a timely manner? Let's bring in Michelle Audette, former Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls Inquiry Commissioner and assistant today to the Vice Rector at the Université Laval in Quebec. Madame Audette, it is nice to see you. Welcome to Power Play. I want to ask you, what was your reaction to the National Action Plan and the federal pathway? Is this what you were expecting when the inquiry sent their final report in 2019?
Well, of course, I was expecting that we wouldn't have to go through a national or a federal election when we presented the report, because knowing that this important work that the women did during this inquiry was going to be a little bit shadow or too much shadow during an election. And I have to say that. And what reassured me today, we had from inside yesterday, we found out who was our warriors who agreed to go inside this huge institution to make sure that what they've heard or what they said during the process of the inquiry from inside, what should be the priorities or what should be told in this preliminary action plan. So that I have to acknowledge their courage and their willingness to do that work inside. So to be honest with your question, I was open mind, open spirit. And when I saw a few of the suggestion or goals that they're proposing, for me, transparency, accountability, and making sure that we have several or different bodies where I can put my complaint or I can go to a tribunal or there's an Indigenous ombudsperson. I was like, finally, we have something there that the Indigenous organization or leadership will have to work with all level of government to make sure that we will see those organizations. Those are important tools for me to make sure that we do the follow-up of calls for justice, call for action, and any reports that was before us or are coming.
So I see that you see some positive things coming out of this, but the government still has to draft and finalize an implementation plan for its federal pathway. Now, do you trust that and do you believe the government to get this plan off the ground before the end of the year?
Two things in your question, very important for me. If we still have the members, the families and the survivors and the expertise coming from the lived experience that work during this process that are still inside this important exercise, yes, I will have my trust. And if also we have and making sure that we're doing this in a good way and in a strong way to make sure that we are saving life in the communities, for me, it's important that to support the organization in Ottawa or the national organization, very important. But in this case, as a former commissioner, the grassroots organization, the families that are doing the advocacy, for me, are the top priority. And I see in the budget, I hope they will make the link or attach this to what they're proposing in this document, that those organizations who save life will be finally honored and able to do the work that they've been asking for so long.
So let me ask you this, Michelle, because you're in Quebec, the federal pathway includes a commitment to advance the Joyce Issaquan principles, a series of measures that include the right of Indigenous people to have equitable access to health care and that without discrimination. The principles are named after Joyce Issaquan, a woman who filmed her racist abuse by staff before dying in a Quebec hospitals. Yeah. So we talked about this before. Provinces also have a role in implementing their portion of National Action's plan. Do you have faith that Quebec, the Quebec government, will recognize that systemic racism and will implement the calls for justice?
Well, after spending the entire time with the family during this inquest in Three Rivers at the Palais de Justice, I was hoping that we could hear a declaration or a statement from the Quebec government. But we've heard other news, important news, where they will be new funding for the Inuit women and family violence and prevention and all of that. So that's very important. But to see if there is a concrete action plan and what's going to be the priorities and where, I'm listening or I'm following what's happening. And I hope that across Canada also that, yes, it was the federal government who called for this national inquiry. But for the first time in the Canadian history, it also involved legally each government across Canada and territories by their orders and council or decree. So it is a shared responsibility. So anxious to see also from there what we will do for the women and the girls across Canada.
Michelle Audette, thank you. Thank you for this. Thanks for coming on our show and have yourself a great weekend.
Merci.
And before we head to break, here's some other news you need to know. Ontario is accelerating its COVID-19 vaccine rollout, allowing more groups to book an earlier second dose appointment starting next week. As of Monday at 8 a.m., those 70 and up and anyone who's had a first dose of an mRNA vaccine before April 18th will be allowed to book an earlier appointment. The province reported its fifth straight day with fewer than 1,000 new COVID-19 cases today, adding 914 infections and 19 deaths. And a second high-ranking military officer has been removed from Canada's vaccine task force because of a pending investigation. The Canadian Armed Forces confirmed Brigadier General Simon Bernard's departure in a statement that reads, a complaint was made regarding language allegedly used by Brigadier General Bernard. The CAF is working towards determining facts and next steps. Brigadier General Bernard's secondment to the Public Health Agency of Canada was scheduled to end in May, but a decision was made to return him to the CAF earlier. He has been placed on annual leave and will be reassigned. And members of the Mass Casualty Commission team are visiting a small Nova Scotia community to continue their probe into the murders of 22 people last April.
It's important for us to actually be here, to walk the roads of this community, to have a better understanding of the physical layout, the geography. So we've been walking around the roads here in the community this morning. That will help us understand the context and circumstances in which these tragedies happened here.
Members of the commission are in Portapique today examining the cause, context, and circumstances of the massacre, including how police and various federal and provincial agencies responded. The inquiry came about after family members of the victims called for answers about how such a tragedy could occur. Many families have been critical of the amount of information the RCMP has shared with them and with the public. And coming up, some people call the U.S. the land of excess. When it comes to vaccines, that statement is very true. The U.S. has enough vaccines on hand that people are worried there isn't enough uptake to use up all the doses before they expire. Windsor's mayor has a plan to scoop up some of those shots. He joins us next. Stay with PowerPlay. And welcome back. People in Windsor are looking for vaccines, and people in Detroit are looking to use up their vaccines before they expire. Given that these two cities are neighbors, this seems like a match made in heaven, right? Well, The Canada-U.S. border is still closed to non-essential travel until June 21st, maybe later. And that non-essential travel includes traveling to the States for the sole purpose of getting a vaccine. So the city of Windsor is looking to create a workaround to that barrier. There is now a line painted in the middle of the Windsor-Detroit tunnel that could allow residents to get a vaccine shot without crossing the border. So will this border loophole work, or will the government crack down on it before it gets off the ground? Let's bring in the man behind this tunnel idea. Windsor Mayor Drew Dilkins joins me now. Mayor, lovely to see you. Love the idea. How did you get that idea, and how do you know it's not going to get shut down?
I'll tell you, I live in a community that is 2 kilometers away from the city of Detroit. And every day, 1,200 people from my community who live here cross the border to work in healthcare in Detroit. Those are pharmacists, nurses, physicians, and the whole gamut of healthcare professionals. About 6 weeks ago, they started calling myself, the head of our hospital, saying, guys, we are throwing doses in the garbage over here. We cannot find arms to put them in. How can you help get people here, Windsorites, over to get these doses so that we don't have to throw them in the landfill? And that started a whole conversation to try and figure out the best path forward. And clearly, the most optimal way is to actually have the doses shipped over here and plugged into our public health system. But we haven't had a response from the federal government on that yet. So it's forced us to look at other creative solutions. And so we did. The tunnel board this week, I went there and I said, here's what I'd like to do. They unanimously said, Drew, you close the tunnel down as often as you need to and for as long as you need to facilitate COVID vaccinations on our property. And by the way, when you do it, draw a line in the middle. Paint a line in the middle of the tunnel so that Canadians can keep their feet on the right side and the Americans can keep up their feet on the right side. And that way, those who are getting vaccinated aren't going to have to be put in quarantine by the public health rules here. You know, this is a very unique situation because of geography, Joyce, where last month in the city of Detroit, they wasted 35,000 doses of Pfizer vaccine, of COVID-19 vaccine, because they couldn't find arms to put them in. And here, much like the rest of Canada, we have people who are desperately waiting for the first shot and then waiting for up to 4 months for the second shot. We've got an answer to help vaccinate people in our community faster. We're trying to make that happen. And if we're successful, it helps everyone else in the country because we all move up the list and that vaccine can be reallocated elsewhere.
Okay, 35,000. You got me at 35,000 doses that went into the garbage. That is shocking, Mayor. But so what is the status of that clinic? And will you need like a border agents? Will they be there? Will they stop this? I'm imagining that maybe the federal government will find a creative way to stop this when, even though you have these Americans practically begging you to take these doses, that they are actually throwing in the garbage. So you told me you have 10,000 people on your waiting list already?
Yeah, in about 5 days, 10,000 people from my community signed up on the wait list to receive the second dose. And we're just talking second dose of Pfizer. We can't get all creative with Moderna. And of course, they don't have AstraZeneca approved in the United States. So this is really a very discrete population. Literally in 5 days, 10,000 people signed up. And so that is the level of interest here. And people are anticipating, Joyce, that the border is going to open. And they know when it opens, they're going to reunite with their family members who they've been separated from for 15 months. They're going to want to get over to the U.S. and see those folks. And the pathway to be exempt from quarantine is full vaccination plus 2 weeks after your last vaccine. So there is some pressure to try and get this done. But to your point and your question about will this get shut down, there's a possibility. I think there's active efforts behind the scenes to try and make sure that we can't make this happen, because I get that the photo op isn't politically palatable. But we're still in the middle of a global pandemic where every province in this country has a declared state of emergency and every city in every province has a declared state of emergency. I'm not worried about elections. I'm worried about the people in my community and how to get them fully vaccinated, because all I keep hearing and the messaging that's coming out is this is a race between the vaccine and the variant. I want my community to win.
So are you worried, Mayor Dilkins, that you will get shut down either by the federal or the provincial government, because the Ontario government is asking Ottawa for stricter measures at the border? That photo opportunity will maybe make, I think that will be a picture that will go around the country. Do you fear that either the provincial or the federal governments will make sure that this doesn't happen?
I think there's going to be reasons. Yeah, I think federally there will be an active effort to make sure it doesn't. Provincially, this is not what Doug Ford was talking about when he was referencing more control of the border. He was talking about the disparity between people flying in and having to spend three nights in a government hotel versus those who are crossing at the land border and being able to just go home. He was pointing out that particular disparity. But listen, we also live on an international waterway. There's no customs out there. And so if I have to get really creative, I can get a boat on the water. I can get an armada of boats. This is one of the busiest waterways in North America here in Windsor, Detroit. We would have no shortage of people who would line up in their boats. And we'll get the Windsor police out there right at the center line with their GPS to demark the border so that everyone stays compliant and stays on the right side of the border. We can get cute and do that. That's obviously not the optimal way to make this happen. But if that's what I have to do to help fully vaccinate my population with doses that are destined for the landfill, I'm prepared to do that.
So when are you going to start this? When is the soonest that you can start this?
I would say by the end of next week, we'd be in a much better position to have traction. So we're working with the pharmacies on the U.S. side. We have to enroll the folks that are registered on the wait list and then have the coordination with the pharmacies. And then, of course, at the same time, we have to work out the coordination with our U.S. partners who operate the Detroit half of the tunnel, but also, of course, U.S. Customs and Border Patrol and Canada Border Services.
Windsor Mayor Drew Dilkins is a very creative man. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I wish you luck. I mean, I'd love to see those shots.
Come down and get your second shot.
And the shots on TV.
Come and get your second shot.
Is that when you're getting your second shot? Thanks so much, Mayor. Have a good weekend.
You too.
And stay with us. Is a federal election on the horizon? The House of Commons is weeks away from rising for the summer. And politicians may be walking into a pandemic trip to the polls. So, are parties election ready? Our strategists weigh in next. And welcome back. The House of Commons is gearing up to rise for the summer later this month. And of note, time has been set aside for politicians who aren't seeking re-election to give their farewell speeches. So, are these the final weeks of Parliament before a federal election? What do parties need to accomplish with the few weeks they have left in the House? Let's bring in our strategist, Greg McEachran from Proof Strategies Leans Liberal. Maureen Harquail is a Conservative commentator and former federal candidate and the chief operating officer of the Ontario Motor Vehicle Industry Council. Anne McGrath is the NDP's national director, and Greg Weston from Ernst Cliff Strategy Group has a nonpartisan perspective. Hello, Strats. Happy Friday. Nice to see you. Greg McEachran, I'm going to start with you because before it rises at the end of this month, the House will hear those goodbye speeches from MPs who are not running again. So, this will happen on June 15th. So the date has already been set. So is this a big hint there will be an election by the fall? I know I always ask you the same question, but this is a big hint, isn't it?
Yeah, I feel like, you know, seeing which way the wind blows from week to week. I think basically everyone is preparing for a fall election, knowing that there might not be one. But, you know, the lesson of the Joe Clark government in 1979, anybody who's worked in a minority government since knows that that's, you know, what you want to avoid, where you are not ready for, you know, whether it's, you know, triggered by yourself or others, you want to be absolutely ready. So next week, what I'll be watching for is a big push, I think, to get the C-12, it's the bill around net zero emissions accountability. The Conservatives have been kind of holding this up at committee. I believe the Bloc and the NDP support it. But why it's, I think, important is, remember back in March, Erin O'Toole during the convention, there was the vote around whether or not climate change was real, and the party said it's not. And, you know, Mr. O'Toole's quote at the time was the last two elections had been fought around a so-called carbon tax, and people think that they're not serious about the environment. I think next week, trying to get this bill moved ahead and passed will be kind of a prelude to what the Liberals want to fight the election on if it's around things that are non-COVID. It'll be things like the environment where they think the Conservatives are weak.
Yeah, there's going to be a mad rush in the next few weeks. And Liberal Party has triggered an election urgency clause to speed up nominations of candidate to run in the next election. I don't want to get into the process, but this is an administrative procedure. It allows for the nomination of more candidates in a shorter period of time. What does the NDP think about that? And do you feel you're getting kind of pushed into an election?
So the evidence has been mounting for ages now, Joyce, that the Liberals want to have an election. I mean, it just is mount every day. There's a new story. This is so certainly this electoral emergency or urgency, whatever it's called, issue around nominations, the speeches in the House for non-returning members, but all sorts of other things too. They have shown time and time again that they really want to have an election at a time that is most opportune for them, which makes sense, at a time that is most opportune for them, when they can get a majority and will be then unconstrained by the accountability of a minority parliament where opposition parties actually have some say. So I think they want one. They're doing everything that they can to have one. There should not be one. It is not right to do it during this pandemic, which is still on. I know people are feeling hopeful right now. I'm feeling hopeful, but the pandemic is still on. In Ontario, children are not going to school. We still have lockdowns. And across the country, we see third and fourth wave outbreaks. So the pandemic is on. There should not be an election. The Liberals want to have one. And so all of the indicators are that they're moving in that direction. I hope it doesn't happen because I think it would be a mistake. I think it would be a problem. Are parties ready?
Yeah, I agree.
Absolutely they are. I think that the parties are ready.
Oh, yes. The parties have already done their nominations. And there's every week, a couple more. So, yes, parties are getting ready. But Greg Weston, I want to ask you this. Conservative backbencher Kathy Wagenthal tabled a private member's bill this week to ban sex-selective abortions. That's abortions based on the gender of the fetus. More than half, in fact, two-thirds of the Conservative caucus voted in favor of the motion. Conservative leader Erin O'Toole voted against it. And MPs were allowed to vote according to their conscience. Will this be a problem for Conservatives, you know, in an election going after more progressive voters?
It's a problem for the Conservatives going into every election, Joyce. And we know that you've covered enough of these elections. So have I, and everybody else around the table today has as well. Abortion, anything to do with it, is always a hot-button issue. And at the beginning of every federal election campaign, journalists try to push the leader, you know, what are you going to do on this issue? And they try and push back. So this is part of what it is to be the conservative leader. You need to bring those disparate factions together under one banner going into the election. Is it insurmountable? No, it's not. Stephen Harper, Brian Mulroney, they've all dealt with this issue before, and they managed to get themselves elected. Is it helpful to them? No, not at all.
Maureen, I want to ask you, so last I checked, the Conservative Party had more money, more candidates already on to run in the next election than the Liberals or really any other party. So the party seems to be election ready. Or would you need more time for Erin O'Toole to make his mark, to become more well-known to Canadians?
Yeah, Joyce, thank you for having me on. And, it's a great question, because we all know that whenever there's a new leader in any party, it takes time for Canadians to get to know them. You know, it's all well and good to say, well, Erin O'Toole. But the reality is, we want Canadians to say, who is that Erin O'Toole? And I think when he won the leadership and he came out and said, I'm Erin O'Toole and I'm the new leader of the Conservative Party, he was really challenging Canadians to look at our party and to realize that there is a different vision and a much more progressive vision of what we stand for. And Erin has been very clear in terms of his stand when it comes to he's pro-choice. He's very supportive of the LGBTQ community. And he has also been obviously very, progressive when it comes to the environmental issues. So there's a new Conservative Party in town.
That is his caucus with him. I don't have a lot of time, but two-thirds of the caucus voted with for this bill to ban sex selective abortion. So, yes, he says he's pro-choice. His office sent me a note yesterday when I did the piece to explain that specifically. But his caucus, two-thirds of it, did not vote with the leader.
And I think what you have to look at, Joyce, is that Canadians from coast to coast are a very diverse group with different views on all of these different issues. And Aaron has also been very clear that
absolutely,
he will welcome those kinds of different views within the party.
Yeah, absolutely. And he does. And he did. It was a free vote. I want to go really fast around the table. The Windsor mayor, Drew Dilkins, he got creative with his shots. I want to start with you, McEachran. Would you go to Windsor to get that second shot? Yes, no. Is it a good idea?
Damn right. And when he said it was on the water, I was like, is there a booze cruise along with it? I'm in.
Okay. Anne, are you on?
I don't think we can have these one-off approaches to the vaccine. The Windsor U.S. border is very, very important. There's lots of relationships across it. But for me, the priority is getting children back into school in Ontario.
I gotta get to Greg Weston. Yes or no, would you go on that boat?
Yeah, just to see the traffic jam. Do you know how busy that tunnel is on a given day? People staying there getting needles in their arms, they'd be run over within seconds. So it's kind of self-defeating.
Okay, that yeah, is unfortunately
that mayor is
gonna
get
all
elected
the time.
For the rest of his life.
That is all the time we have. Thank you to the strategists, and thank you to you. That's your Power Play Day in politics.